You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, biodiversity is under threat around the United States. We'll talk to a conservation expert and a Wisconsin advocate about why the habitats of many threatened species remain unprotected. Now we're taking another look at the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Russian troops appear to be moving eastward within the country after being pushed out of the capital region and areas in the north. There are growing concerns about war crimes with attacks on hospitals and schools, and there appears to be evidence in Bucha of a wave of execution-style killings. Meanwhile, President Zelensky is asking the United States for more support, requesting military aid, and asking Western countries to invoke stronger sanctions against Russia. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the U.S. is doing enough to support Ukraine? Should the U.S. send over more weapons? Are we already doing too much, do you think? What questions do you have about what's going on in Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Russian forces apparently have been pushed, or at least withdrawn, away from Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. They're headed eastward to the area where Russia was already declaring those parts independent. What have you been watching for in those particular developments over the last week?
Well, unfortunately, what the world has seen is that the pullout of Russian troops has left a wake of civilian casualties that many people are talking about in terms of war crimes and just atrocities that are hard to stomach. So on the one hand, the pullout is good. It means Ukraine has recaptured territory north of its capital. But I think many people expect that this doesn't mean necessarily a reduction in the war effort by Russia, but a reconfiguration and a stronger push in the south and the east.
I want to talk about what Russia is hoping to get out of this. There was an editorial that's gotten a lot of attention in a state-run Russian news outlet titled "What Russia Must Do with Ukraine." Here's some quotes from it in translation. "Denazification must be de-Ukrainization. Ukraine may not exist as a national state. Any attempt to create it leads to Nazism." Another quote, "Elites must be liquidated. They cannot be re-educated. The social swamp who supported them must experience terror of war and learn the lesson and pay for its guilt." That, in addition to the war crimes you mentioned, that seems like a state-approved justification for war crimes. What do you make of that and other statements from Russian media and leaders?
Yeah, well, it is really important to watch what they are saying. That is pretty clearly a sort of genocidal statement that denies the right of Ukraine to exist as a state and actually calls for punishing civilians in Ukraine. So it's a very dangerous statement. And we know that the media in Russia is at this point totally controlled by the government. So there has to be some level of approval. On the other hand, I think one of the things to note is that the Russian government has tried out different rationales for explaining this war to its population, including claiming that they were winning, that there's very few casualties, that everything's going fine. I think it's going to be harder and harder for the government to claim that there's no casualties, that there's no losses, and they're going to have to explain why so much damage is being inflicted on Ukraine. So I think this is an attempt for another step in this denazification rationale, which is a absurd claim that Ukraine has been taken over by Nazis and they need to be stopped. So it's a very serious statement, but I think it is also a sign of desperation on the part of the government in order to come up with a rationale for its war losses.
Russia, there were some leaked documents early on that suggested that Russia thought within a few days this war would have been over. They would have been in control of Ukraine and controlling the destiny of the country. That clearly didn't happen. What, to the extent that we can understand it, what is the Russian goal now? Are they hoping to still control all of Ukraine, to destroy Ukraine, to control parts of it? I can't puzzle it out.
Yeah, I don't think they are capable of, quote, winning at this point. I think that they are capable of inflicting much more damage and causing many more civilian casualties. So that's the scary part that I think of. But in terms of what their goals were, you know, remember initially the idea behind it, to the extent there was a rational plan, was to recognize the independence of those two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, in the east. And supposedly they were going there to help Russian citizens, Russian ethnic Russians living in those areas. And instead of just focusing on those areas, they moved towards Kiev and towards a larger invasion. So that led a lot of people to think that what they were trying to do was to take over the whole government, replace the Zelensky government with a sort of puppet government. And I think they were delusional enough to think that that would actually work. And delusional, I say, because they don't recognize the resolve and the commitment to a Ukrainian nation that we're seeing throughout Ukraine. So I think they initially thought it would be easy. They could just replace the government. It would be very simple. But they are not finding many collaborators. The Zelensky government did not fold, and the Ukrainian army has been tougher and more resilient than many people thought they would be. So at this point, what is their plan? Possibly to capture the south and east so that they have a connection between Crimea and those two areas of the Donbass that they want. But I don't know at this point that they're even going to be successful in that more limited goal.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, political scientist, specialist in Russian and post-Soviet states at UW-Madison, looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I want to give a listen to Ukrainian President Zelensky making a pre-recorded speech at the Grammys over the weekend. Here's a listen.
We defend our freedom to live, to love, to sound. On our land, we are fighting Russia, which brings horrible silence with its bombs, the death silence. Feel the silence with your music. Feel it today to tell our story.
President Zelensky calling on the music community there, but also calling for more support from the U.S. and the Western world. What tools are still in the toolkit for the U.S. and Europe when it comes to supporting Ukraine?
Well, there's, I think, two really important directions. One is further military aid to Ukraine. I think that that's going on, and I think there's discussions now, especially in light of the atrocities that we saw over the weekend, in terms of doing more. So I think there's more, there are options for more military aid. And that I think is first and foremost, because I don't think Putin is going to stop until he is stopped militarily. Second is the sanctions. And there are, there's a range of additional sanctions that can still be put in place, including additional financial sanctions, additional secondary sanctions. But most importantly is the cutting off of revenue to the Russian government through cutting energy exports, primarily from Europe. So that's, I think, the big discussion going on now is how can Europe find a way to reduce 30% of its energy supply rather quickly. And I guess I would say for our American audience, in terms of what we can do, the U.S. is the largest producer of oil and gas, but we're also the largest consumer. And so when we want to support Ukraine, I think one of the things that we have to think about is how might we shift some of our consumption and exports to Europe to make up for some of the gap from Russia. So I think there's a lot of things that could be done, maybe not immediately, but there are ways to move away from buying Russian oil and gas. And that's going to be the key in reducing income for the Putin government.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Hi. I don't think that America has much credibility to deal with the situation over there. We've invaded, I don't know, maybe a dozen countries in the last 10 years, probably 50 countries at least before that point in time. But I think right from the beginning that they should have been like France, because anyone that knows anything about military stuff, Ukraine is not going to win. At least with France, when the Germans came in, they knew their country was going to be destroyed. So they let them come in and they worked from the inside. At least they still had a country intact. this country is going to look like Syria. Every building, actually, it won't be that bad, but it'll be bad enough. The country is partially destroyed already.
Dan, thanks for the call. Dan says, I guess Ukraine should have let the invasion roll in. I mean, I think Russia has demonstrated a willingness to kill people under areas that they control with or without military resistance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that perspective definitely has its supporters, even in U.S. government. I mean, there are some people who think Ukraine should have just accepted as a fait accompli a Russian invasion. But yeah, the big worry is what we see under areas that were under Russia control is these mass killings of civilians and atrocities. And so that should give anybody pause about saying, well, if Ukrainians had just gone along with it, everything would have been fine. So I think that's probably not what would have happened if Ukraine had just surrendered immediately. But the other thing I think that's really important in this conflict is the moral clarity and the willingness of Ukrainians to fight in this case. Ukrainians are doing all the fighting. They're asking for weapons and supplies from NATO countries. And so it's a bit different from Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq in the sense of there isn't a complex situation of who might be in charge, who to support, which group wants what. There was a democratically elected government in place that's still in place. And so what to do in this case is not actually that complicated. And I think that's one of the reasons there's so much unity and support for Ukraine is because it's such a simply wrong situation in terms of the Russian invasion.
Yoshiko Herrera stays with us, political scientist, professor at UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, giving an update on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the U.S. do? What do you want to see the U.S. not do when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with political scientist Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, looking at Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the U.S. and Western response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the U.S. role in Ukraine so far? Should we be doing more, doing less? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko, weapons, humanitarian aid, assent from the U.S. and Western Europe, very much reluctance to do things like no-fly zones or anything that might lead to, in effect, you Americans and Russians shooting at each other. Could you talk about that reluctance?
Yeah, the reluctance is that Russia is a nuclear power. The United States, NATO have nuclear weapons. And so the big danger is that an escalation into a direct conflict between NATO and Russia could lead to a nuclear exchange. That's the big danger. On the other hand, the other side of things is to sit back and watch these mass atrocities and war crimes. And so that's the dilemma. There are no good answers here. I think so we can't say if somebody wants a no-fly zone. No-fly zone means shooting down Russian planes. It means shooting down, shooting areas that supply planes, airports, et cetera, within Russia. So no-fly zone, to some extent, to the extent it's enforced, actually means engagement between NATO and Russia. And so that's the reluctance on the no-fly zone per se. But I think the examples from the Cold War, where there were proxy wars, where we had the same dilemma, is that we should expect NATO in this case to do everything it can short of a formal engagement with Russia. So that's where I think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes and the supporting Ukraine militarily. It's right for Ukrainians to keep pushing for more, but I think a lot of that is happening sort of behind the scenes. And the main reason for that is to avoid a direct confrontation, which could be very dangerous.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question. This would be much further down the road, but I wondered Would there ever be an opportunity for Ukraine to seek reparations from Russia for an unprovoked attack?
Tom, that's a great question. Morally, Yoshiko, it seems like, of course. Practically, it seems unlikely.
Yeah, it's very hard to say, especially if Russia is kicked out of various European institutions, which might be the place for adjudicating claims like that. Yes, I agree with you completely that morally, yes, practically, it's not clear. On the other hand, all this seizure of Russian assets abroad, it's not clear what's going to happen to those assets, but I could see that there may be a case to be made for using those towards reparations or rebuilding Ukraine.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine with Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Yoshiko, I want to look at the view inside Russia now. I know public opinion in an authoritarian country is hard to gauge. The closest thing to independent surveys, though, seem to show a lot of support for Vladimir Putin since the invasion and support for the invasion yourself. How much can we know about that?
I think that what we know is there are a lot of people in Russia who support Putin, and that support for Putin translates into support for the role for the war. But we also know that there is a lot of discontent and there are a lot of people who don't support Putin. However, in the repressive context that we have now in Russia, where Putin has really cracked down on people, I mean, he is arresting young people for posts on social media from five years ago at this point. He's arresting high school students who posted parts of the Russian Constitution in their newspaper. I mean, he's really cracked down on people. And so people are not answering surveys in droves because it's just simply not worth the risk. So I think knowing the precise level of support for Putin versus for the war versus against him and against the war, it's very hard to say right now. And I would not take those surveys to be very meaningful. I don't think they tell us whether support for the war has gone up or not, or whether support for Putin has gone up or not because of the repressive context that's been instituted since the war started.
Right. If I were in Russia, I might be very reluctant to tell even an independent pollster, yeah, no, I don't like Putin, assume that that would stay confidential.
Right. There's absolutely no incentive to do that. I mean, if you were going to wage a protest against the regime, that seems like not something I would risk it for. As a social scientist, I hate to say that, but I'm not sure a supposedly anonymous survey is what people are going to risk punishment for.
Where does this end up? How can there be any kind of negotiated settlement when at least part of the philosophy of the invading nation is that the invaded nation doesn't actually exist and the people don't exist as a separate entity?
Yeah, I think that at this point, unfortunately, Putin is going to stop when he is stopped militarily. So I don't really see anything other than a military defeat stopping him at this point. The sanctions are important because they weaken the state capacity in Russia and they weaken his ability to wage war. But they're not going to convince him that he's done something wrong because he simply doesn't care. So I think that that's why I think there has to be a strategy of both supporting Ukraine militarily and keeping up with the sanctions in order to weaken the government. In terms of Putin's survival within Russia, I think that hinges on whether he can convince people that the destruction of the economy and the destruction that is happening in Ukraine is not his fault. And I think that's a tall order. And I think we can see from the censorship, the repression, et cetera, that their strategy of normal media control isn't working very well. But I think whether he's able to deflect blame is going to determine the survival of his regime. But in terms of the war stopping, I think that is unfortunately going to be up to the Ukrainians.
Time for one more caller. Gary is with us in Kaukauna. Gary, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Hey, I got a couple of things. One is that I believe that we keep hearing all these sanctions that have been imposed over the last 9 months or whatever. You know, I haven't seen the scorecard on that. What's worked? What hasn't worked? How many sanctions we have left and what's left in the quiver, so to speak?
Gotcha. I'm going to leave you there, Gary, because you don't have a ton of time left. Yoshiko, what do we know about the sanctions, especially the ones imposed in the last couple of months, how they've worked, and how much we have left in the tank to do more?
Yeah, well, so it's only been 40 days, really, since they've been imposed. I think the sanctions so far are unprecedented in scale, scope, and speed. I think a lot of experts on a scale of 1 to 10 would say we're at a 7 or an 8. So there is more to do, and more to do primarily focuses on cutting the energy exports and secondary sanctions, secondary financial sanctions. So there is more that can be done, and I would not be surprised this week if we see more of that happening in light of what happened over the weekend.
And in our last minute or so, Yoshiko, you mentioned earlier Russia potentially being removed from important world bodies. I think the UN Human Rights Commission may be kicking off the Russian representative, Ukraine, calling for Russia to be booted from the UN Security Council, taking away their veto. How significant would that be?
Well, it would be significant, but the UN moves very slowly. Mm-hmm. So I think the kicking them off the Human Rights Council is kind of a symbolic measure. It doesn't mean a lot. If they were to be removed from the Security Council, that would be a whole reshaping of the UN architecture. But I expect that would take a long time, and I wouldn't hold my breath for that.
And what do you have your eye on mostly this week?
Well, I think that the military aid and additional sanctions are what we need to do in terms of supporting Ukraine. And the other thing is, I think on the military front, it's just important to see where Russia is moving, what their actions are, because clearly their words are not very meaningful at this point.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, a political scientist and professor at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at the latest news in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, what it could take to end that invasion, and what to watch for in the weeks to come. Now, scientists last summer published the most detailed biodiversity loss map ever created. The map shows parts of the United States where plant and animal species are at the highest risk of global extinction. But when you overlay that with a map of protected land, as the New York Times recently did, the two don't always match up. We're talking about the threat of losing animal and plant species and why the habitats of those species aren't always protected. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about biodiversity? Do you think more land needs to be protected one way or another for biodiversity? Are you involved in a project in your community or on your land? Prairie restoration, for example, or other conservation efforts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Naughton is a professor in the Geography Department at UW-Madison. She studies biodiversity conservation in the tropics and has also studied wolf recovery in Wisconsin. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into the specifics of conservation, could you just talk a little bit about the value of biodiversity? Why do we worry about the risks to plant and animal species?
Well, for one, it has deep value in the quality of our lives. I was speaking with a colleague who lives in the North Woods, grew up in the North Woods, never dreamed that he would hear a wolf, but now he hears them with his young sons and just says it's an incalculable joy to hear that. So we have the sort of intrinsic value, the moral value of sharing our beautiful planet with all forms of life. But more and more, we're learning from ecologist studies that more diverse ecosystems are better able to be resilient to change, better able to bounce back from drought, to bounce back from fire. So that biodiversity in our ecosystems is also helping keep our ecosystems functioning, our water clear, and enhancing in a direct way the livability of our environment.
Now, I mentioned comparing and contrasting those two maps. So where we look at, okay, here are places with threats to biodiversity. Here are the lands we're really doing a lot to protect. They don't always line up. How hard is it to line up special protections of regions of land with where the greatest need is?
That's such a good question. And indeed, all too often, protected areas, as valuable as they are, our protected areas were established in places that were perceived as having low agricultural value or low economic potential. So that left out some of our precious ecosystems like native grasslands. Or given the timing of the establishment of many of our parks and reserves, it left out the southeastern part of the country, the lower Appalachias, places where there was no open public land to set aside. It was all under private property. So the challenge persists. Some of our most species-rich habitats are on private lands outside of parks and reserves.
Sometimes I think it can seem like an all or nothing. This land is completely protected, no human involvement here. This is private land developed. But of course, in reality, there's a lot of middle ground. Do you see a lot of potential to find sort of halfway measures where we can take that private land or that partially developed land and still keep biodiversity in mind?
Yeah, we have to. That's the challenge before us. Biodiversity demands that we manage our ecosystems at a landscape level. Protected areas are essential, but they're inadequate. We just can't set aside a big enough area that biodiversity will be guaranteed. So we have to work with private landowners. That inevitably involves some compromise, but it's urgent. I was just thinking of a happy story amid all the biodiversity sad stories. I think it's important to remember how in this very state, we have now eagles nesting in every county. The DNR and Madison Audubon just announced that. In fact, I heard it on NPR and looked it up. That is thanks to laws that were passed in 1972 against DDT. As a girl, and like many of your listeners, perhaps as children, you didn't see great blue herons or bald eagles. And now they've bounced back. I bring that up also because it shows that we need to keep our eye on biodiversity beyond protected areas. We need to keep our eye on agricultural land use and industrial land use that may have cascading effects for biodiversity. And with effort, we can push back. We can turn things around for some species.
Talking to Lisa Naughton, professor in the Geography Department at UW-Madison, about efforts to protect and preserve biodiversity in the United States and beyond. I want to go beyond now, Lisa. You've done work in the tropics where there is a lot of biodiversity. What kind of efforts, hopefully successful efforts, have you seen in your work to protect some of the most biodiverse parts of the planet?
Well, much of my work is in Latin America, and to a certain extent, the protected areas were established there in the 1970s and more recently when biodiversity was a clearer goal. And so they are, many of them, better placed to save biodiversity in tropical Latin America, say. The challenge is...
I think we've lost Lisa there. We'll see if we can bring her back. We're talking about biodiversity efforts to protect it. Coming up, we're going to meet a Wisconsin effort that's trying to protect the whole watershed around Lake Superior. Lisa, do we have you back? We do not. We will pick up that part of the conversation coming up. And you could join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in efforts maybe on your own land or in your community to preserve habitat for, well, what? Tell us what habitat you've been working to preserve, whether it's prairie or forest or wetland. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up our conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about at-risk species in our state and beyond, ways to protect biodiversity. We've got Lisa Naughton back with us from UW-Madison, and also joining us now, Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy, an organization that seeks to protect Lake Superior and the Laurentian Forest Province in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. He's also the founder of Milwaukee Riverkeeper, an environmental advocacy organization from Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick Rivers. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, go ahead.
The Superior Bioconservancy is looking to really protect the biodiversity of this region. And if you think of it just in terms of what's biodiversity, what's important is that you are an organism, your body. So within your body, you have viruses and bacteria, millions of these and fungi that basically operate and keep your system running. So one of the most important features of keeping biodiversity is understanding the function of what things do and why it's important. So you wouldn't go into your car and take the carburetor and throw it away just because you didn't like the way it looked or way it smelled. So there's a health of the system is, and we have two keystone species that are very important for the functionality of this region in our North Woods. And those wetlands up there are some of the most biodiverse that we have. Those are our coral reefs or our tropical rainforests in terms of species richness, let's say, per square meter. And so one of the, there's two species that have a significance in Wisconsin, beavers and wolves. And wolves help the forest significantly because they affect how deer browse. And when, before we had the landscape, so back to 1973, when the Endangered Species Act was enacted, there were probably about 200 wolves in northeast Minnesota. Now there's about 4,400 going across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula. So the function that they provide is they basically frighten the deer and they change their behavior to more of a predator-prey relationship. And deer will remove up to 40% of the plant species if they're unregulated and they just keep growing. It's like having a herd of goats. So these other species like Canadian Hugh or White Cedar, when they disappear, the forest itself becomes less robust, and there's because of its loss of species richness, because forests are a community of plants. So it, if you have a pack of wolves, they are wide ranging. So you might have 75 miles for a pack of a pack range for, let's say, five wolves. So that's about 15 square miles per one wolf. And the forest, the function of it is they serve almost like an antibody so that they change the behavior. So these areas where they frequent, you get this regeneration of all these species that get eliminated when you have too many deer.
And in just a minute, Bob, I want to ask about some of the specifics of the work of how you're working to preserve that. Lisa, we've got you back in now. What we're hearing from Bob there, is that an example of the kind of work we have to do in biodiversity in any particular ecosystem?
Yes, indeed. I couldn't agree more that we're not aiming at just collecting a certain species. We're trying to keep that web of life going and the interactions between those keystone species and the habitat.
And Bob, what you were just talking about, you're working on, you know, not just in one place, one forest. You're kind of working around almost the entire lakeshore and beyond of Lake Superior. Can you talk about just the scope of your effort to preserve the species and ecosystems you were just describing?
Right. So if you take the whole United States side, which is take the national forests, county forests, and state forests of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, it's 21 million acres. And what we are mapping is connecting corridors to put linkages between these corridors to avoid fragmentation, to allow genetic exchange, and really to have evolution to continue. So no different than you need to be able to let's say, go to the bank, the hardware store, or the grocery store. Animals need to be able to migrate and populate and fluctuate across this landscape. And one of the key features that we're interested in seeing is introduction, so to speak, of allowing beavers to thrive across the landscape because they affect the hydrology. So what beavers, it isn't just a critter, but when they build dams, this is a type of architecture that completely changes the hydrology of the rivers. So if we want healthy rivers, rivers that are less likely to flood, and each one of these ponds that they build also are one of the richest areas where we have for biodiversity, for great blue herons, ducks, and birds, because they become the engines of productivity. So we're looking across this landscape as sort of a regional planning for the ecology of the area, but also looking at its carbon aspect. So it's a high carbon landscape. And we hope to also continue up into the Canadian side, into Ontario. So the entire watershed of Lake Superior is protected, in essence. This is the most important freshwater body in this hemisphere, perhaps the most, probably the most important and the purest in the world. So its volume of water and its future for the planet as a freshwater resource, and how those inputs, all those rivers and watersheds that drain into that, need to be in a type of status that they are functioning at high ecological value because its essence, it's saving ourselves as well as saving our landscape here in the upper Midwest.
And Bob, I wanted to ask more about beavers in particular. For a long time, they were an economic resource for their fur. There are places in the country where they're seen as a nuisance by property owners because they change the hydrology. And you don't want that in your yard necessarily. How do you start to build a consensus in a community, whether it's along Lake Superior or maybe even in Milwaukee County, that, hey, they are neighbors we want?
It's an excellent question. It's really a coexistence. It's a coexistence issue. So you can control the levels of flooding that beavers to avoid nuisance flooding using flow devices. So this is uses like a stack pipe, and you run a pipe through the dam, or you put a type of fencing around culverts or places that you don't want them to blocking. So you can work with them effectively in a co-management way. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is probably has the worst beaver policy in the United States because they don't recognize this ecological value. It's important to keep them where you can control them. But for the Milwaukee River, for instance, I worked on a study with two university professors, and we showed by if we had beavers reinstated in the upper Milwaukee River watershed, for example, we would lower peak flood levels in downtown Milwaukee 37%. Now, that from an economic value, ecosystem service value, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, which has flood authority and paid for the study, for them, that's worth over $3 billion in flood relief. So what you where you could have beavers have an advantage for you is by mitigating flooding. So with climate change, we're getting instability in the system, and so we're getting big rains occasionally. We've had big flooding in pockets of area, and you can, in essence, restrengthen your whole hydrology of all your rivers. In pre-settlement, our rivers were completely different. So it's a matter of thinking of this as how can we live with this animal and get the benefits and also the biodiversity, water quality, recharging aquifers benefit.
And Lisa, when we lost you earlier, you were talking about Central America in particular, and that what Bob was just talking about, building neighborhoods and partnerships between humans and the other animals and species. Have you seen success stories like that in your work in Central America?
Yes, definitely. I've seen success stories. It's I must say, though, it's challenging that enlisting local community members means expanding the different goals that the landscape is managed for, and there's often conflict. One of the places I work in South America, there's a gold rush underway. Very poor people, very biodiverse, carbon-heavy forest, but full of gold. And in such situations, the sort of shared management becomes very difficult.
We're talking to Lisa Naughton from UW-Madison and Bob Boucher, president and founder of the Superior Bioconservancy, looking at wildlife habitat preservation, biodiversity preservation in Wisconsin and around the world. Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see the DOT start planting trees in our native plants inland so we could leave our wetlands alone and, bring back the native bees and birds and things inland.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Bob, you're thinking about Lake Superior, but you're doing work well inland. Is that part of the story, native plants, trees, native bees?
Well, forests provide carbon, and what we're looking at is changing some of the policies on the national forest, the county forest, and state forest. Those trees provide a more stable environment for us by standing. You can still have forestry, but we need to allow a lot of it to go back to an old growth type of status. You get a whole structure there that allows certain species to thrive, like goshawks and martens, that we don't have, though they're both endangered in Wisconsin, because we don't have any old forests to speak of, that most people don't recognize that we had trees that were 400 or 500 years old. And to walk in those types of environments is a very unique and in many ways sort of a spiritual experience. It's a cathedral.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Michael in Wauwatosa. Michael, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to throw in my support for what your guest is speaking of. As far as the beavers, I've gone through hikes through Schwamigan and Nicolet, and I can see these old beaver dams that I just look back and I see what they created and the diversity, and now it's some of them are dried up, you know, the pond that would have been back there. And I just wish that the DNR, that the state would allow a beaver sanctuaries in certain areas, like in the Shawmigan and Nicolet. And then the other thing I wanted to bring up is I've got property in north central Wisconsin, and I'm big on planting native trees and especially oaks. And I have to wire up every tree at least 5 feet high, make a cage around it with woven steel, because if I don't, the deer will just strip the leaves off. And I think the deer have created an ecological disaster in a lot of areas. They've devastated the understory and anything that, you know, consequently, that since there's no understory, the wildlife that would have depended on them is gone. And I'm just thrilled to have the wolves back in the area, and I'm a longtime deer hunter.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Bob, Michael, a lot of what he said lined up with what you were talking about earlier. It makes me think on a wider level, are there things that individual landowners or maybe businesses or communities that own land can do to help with the kind of work you're doing on around Lake Superior and elsewhere?
Well, yeah, by having beavers in the landscape, the current, for instance, management of beavers in Wisconsin is 5 months long, unlimited season. They don't keep track of who gets what. So there's no, it's an unregulated season. So there's, if you had anything where you don't have any limits, you don't keep track of what you have, you don't know what you have. So it's a very poor management policy. Wolves provide the type of service that, you know, they move the deer around, and your forests are really damaged significantly by deer. When you have wolves on it, your forest is healthier. And because it has this other diversity to it and as a community. So from a productivity standpoint, just from a public standpoint of getting more wood pulp and a healthier forest, more robust and more carbon, having wolves is probably the cheapest, easiest, healthiest thing we can do for ourselves.
And for people who want to do landscape restoration, things like that, Bob, are there ways they can work with your organization to be part of the bigger picture?
Well, we can try to get support for understanding that to avoid fragmentation and hire, or I shouldn't say hire, but vote for people who vote for the environment and for biodiversity and recognize that we need to have that. It's the system we live in. The earth is an organism. We live in it as an organism. And its health and our health are completely directly related. With the climate crisis, there's also a biodiversity crisis. The UN has agreed to that. We lack political will in a way. And so there needs to be voices like your caller there to address this issue and demand action, because it's critical.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Lisa, thanks for staying with us.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
I've been talking to Bob Boucher, founder and president of the Superior Bioconservancy. That's an organization that seeks to protect Lake Superior and the Laurentian Forest Province in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. Also with us, Lisa Naughton, professor in the Geography Department at UW-Madison. Both of them work on issues related to biodiversity in Wisconsin and beyond. Still time to share your story. If you work with a conservation effort in your community or elsewhere, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.